Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 14th, 1999, and in fireside room this morning is Barbara Rossing, Ecology and the Bible, Agriculture's Bitter Bounty, Deforestation, Globalization, and the Bible Critique of It. Let's listen in.
So roll the tape here. Welcome, everybody. My name is Barbara Rossing. I was happy to have a guest lecturer yesterday, Jim Martin Tram, to talk about the two different creation accounts in the book of Genesis. Monday, we talked about the issue of the Bible and ecology from the perspective of sacred places in the Old Testament, how in the thesis of Mircea Eliade, there are three principal kinds of sacred places for most peoples of the world. They are a sacred mountain, a sacred tree, or a sacred place of water, a water source or a river or a spring. We looked at some of those in the Old Testament. And we also started looking at what I want to continue as a sort of a grounding document for us. That is this brand new Roman Catholic bishop's pastoral letter on the Columbia River watershed, called the Columbia River Watershed Realities and Possibilities. The principal author or instigator of this is Bishop Skillstead from Spokane, but all the other bishops from the surrounding dioceses, including British Columbia, Montana, Idaho, Portland, and various other ones in Washington have also signed on, and I think it's a really interesting document. There's one copy on reserve in the library. It's a 60-page document, so we didn't want to chop down too many trees and make too many copies here, but there is one copy on reserve. You can get it when you go back home on the webpage if you're interested. It's this www.columbiariver.org. But anyway, I want to sort of keep using that where applicable to talk about dilemmas. Today, the dilemma of agriculture and how the globalized agricultural economy that we see in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament might say something or not to us today about how we live on the land and our relationship to the land. So that's the topic, using an article called Bitter Bounty that I'll talk more about. I want to pick up today. Yesterday, Jim Martin Tram showed you how in Genesis 1 and 2, there are actually, most scholars think, two different creation stories. The first one is not the oldest one. The first one in Genesis 1 is authored by the one we call the priestly writer. This is the person or group of persons who had the final sort of shaping of the Pentateuch during the time of the exile when the priests were in more power. Genesis 1 was added on as a kind of preface, and that became then the first creation story. And that's the one that has that was sort of a response to the Babylonian creation epics that had humans as only servants of the gods, that thought the stars and other elements were themselves divine. The Genesis 1 makes clear that it's God who created the universe in an orderly way. Humans are created in the image of God as a kind of crown of creation. And according at least to the thesis of this guy, Theodor Hebert, who wrote this book called The Yahwist's Landscape, the Genesis 1, the priestly writers, is a kind of hierarchical perspective about the relationship between humans and natures, or humans and nature. And Jim showed that yesterday on the chart. That was a proposal. Genesis 2, which we think is the first creation story chronologically written, we think it's written by the writer named, whom we name the Yahwist, is actually the older one. And this is the one that presents humans as fundamentally farmers. And that's the thesis of this guy that Jim presented to you yesterday, the Yahwist landscape, is that in the view of the Yahwist, humans are created from humus. Or farmers are created from farmland. That's how Ted Hebert translates the verse. We are related to the soil. We're created out of the soil, and we are somehow related to the soil. We both come from the soil, and it's our vocation to till and to keep the soil. And that the fundamental view in that narrative of creation is from the perspective of people as subsistence farmers. So the Hebrew word is adama, from which we're created. And this can be variously translated. Ted Hebert suggests that it should be translated as arable land or farmland to underscore that idea of farming. in Genesis 2, I don't think we picked up on this too much yesterday, the contrast between the two creation stories in the role of water is an interesting one to note. In Genesis 1, there was too much water to begin with. It was the whole earth was a watery chaos, according to this perspective, and the waters had to be separated in order to make land where people and other animals could live. So the waters had to be divided so that some were up above the dome or the firmament, and some were down, and in between them there could be dry land. So in a sense, the problem in Genesis 1 is too much water. In Genesis 2, however, the problem that creation addresses is not enough rain. Rain hadn't yet started to fall. In fact, let's take a look at that in Genesis 2, verse 5. And this is where Ted Hebert argues we fundamentally see the understanding of the Yahwist that people are meant to be farming. Genesis 2, verse 5. Ted Hebert translates the verse this way. You know, it starts out, in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. Okay, and then you follow along with what you got. He writes, before any pasturage was on earth and before any field crops had sprung up. Those are his translations of the two words there that you might have as no herb had yet sprung up, no plant of the field. He says the first one is the word for pasturage. That's where the sheep and the goats pasture. And the second one is the word for field crops like wheat and barley and other crops on the land. So that this is a reflection of the fact that saying basically before there was any farming or any herding. For the Lord God had not yet caused it to rain upon the earth. So that's the issue. There wasn't yet rain, and this author knows that you need rain for farmers to be able to live. Then... and there was no one to till the ground. So it's saying that creation happened sort of before all this, and the function of people then is to till the ground, and you need rain, and field crops will spring up and pasturage. Okay, so then the Lord God formed the human out of the humus, or formed the farmer out of the farmland, or however you want to translate that next verse. It's typically translated here as formed man from the dust of the ground, but there's a relationship there between Adam, which is the human person, and Adama, which is the ground. And Ted argues that it should be translated in the sense of farming. So fundamentally, at least according to this thesis, the vocation of people is to be farmers in the Old Testament. Now, that's really different for most of us. I don't know. I just am interested. How many of you grew up on farms? Are some of you from... Oh, good. Okay, because at the first session, we didn't have anybody. Great. So we need you to help us. How many of you now live on farms? Anybody? Yeah, not surprisingly, because farmers can't come to Holden in the summer. They're busy working. This isn't the time of year to come here if you're a farmer. But anyway, okay, good. So we've got some of you who know sort of the farm situation and have roots in the farmland. That's good, because we need that. I'm not an expert at all on farming. Do you resonate with this Old Testament stuff about the farmer and the farmland and this creation account then, those of you who say you're from a farm? Okay. Great. We see this continuing then throughout the Yahwist account. And scholars have the whole sort of thing divided into who they think wrote what parts. If you take a look, we'll just go a little bit more through here and see how it develops. After the fall then, after sin enters the world, then Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden. Actually, Hebert has a side little thing. It's very interesting where he thinks the Garden of Eden landscape is a description not of the farming, the hill land where the farmers were located principally in Israel. How many of you have been to Israel? Okay, so there are several of you. You know that the hill country, which is now Palestine, is rich in these little farms. If you go down to the Dead Sea, though, it's very, very dry. But then what you see is these oases, like Jericho is a beautiful, wonderful oasis where green just springs up. And En Gedi is another one along the Dead Sea. Hebert thinks that the Garden of Eden is most closely related to these oasis economies and the oasis, the idea of paradise in the midst of a really dry land, that's what the Yahwist has in mind with that. But anyway, that's kind of an aside. Okay, take a look at Genesis 8 here. After the flood, then, that is part of the Yahwist narrative, when the flood waters withdraw. Then at the very end of Genesis 8 comes this blessing of Noah and his family. I will never again curse the ground because of humankind. I will never again destroy every living creature as I have done. And then verse 22 of this, which you probably have, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat. I want to read you Ted Hebert's translation, because he says this too is setting up the agricultural seasons. It's, and his translation of this verse, Genesis 8, 22, is as follows. For all the earth's days, planting grain and harvesting grain, cold season and hot season, summer harvest and autumn harvest, day and night shall not cease. So the promise to Noah is cast in terms of these harvest seasons and planting seasons. It's the whole year of the farmer that is recapped in this blessing that tells, you know, all year long I will bless you. And it's, and the year then is defined in terms of the planting and harvest season. So it's very much a farming perspective. In chapter 9, Noah plants a vineyard and becomes the first farmer. That's in Genesis 9, verse 20. It says, Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. So here the farming economy kind of starts. And obviously that was the tension between Cain and Abel that was earlier in the primeval narrative. I want to show you just a couple other texts that underscore this sort of farming vocation. If you look at Exodus 34, I know we're kind of doing jumping around here, but that's the trouble when you do a topic rather than a book. Next week we'll do Revelation again, so those of you who want to stick around and just do one book, sign up for another week and we'll... but this week we're jumping around. Okay, Exodus 34. What's interesting about this text is this is a version of the Sinai, you know, Moses going up on Mount Sinai and getting the Ten Commandments. It's not the only version. It's not the one we usually read. And what happens here is that the Ten Commandments are different from what we think of as the Ten Commandments. Namely, they're much more about farming and the cycles of the farming year than we realize. So that in the midst of, for example, look at verse 17, you know, you shall not make cast idols. Then the very next one is you shall keep the festival of unleavened bread, an agricultural festival here, the Passover. And then look down at verse 21, the Sabbath is described, and the whole sort of issue is how Israel is going to live on the land, how the farming economy, the farming life is to be structured. And this gives specific instructions here about the agricultural festivals that they're to observe. Would someone be willing to read verses 21 and 22 here in Exodus 34?
6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. Even in plowing time and in harvest time you shall rest. You shall observe the festival of weeks, the first fruits of wheat harvest, and the festival of ingathering at the turn of the year.
Okay, so this is naming specific agricultural festivals. The liturgical calendar of Israel was set up at the very beginning here around these planting and harvest kinds of festivals for the different crops, the wheat harvest, and the harvesting of their other crops. What do any of you grown up on a farm think about this Sabbath day business, even in planting and harvesting time? This is a dilemma, right?
Well, I will tell you that my uncle still has a home farm, and we were up there, and it was Sunday, and his son wanted to go out and see if the wheat was dry, and he said, well, you can do that, but we won't be cutting it because it's Sunday, and we rest.
Anybody else?
Well, I didn't grow up on a farm, but we live in a agricultural community, and I think most of our farmers are out there on Sunday. Yeah, even the Lutheran ones, yes. Really, it's I mean, we know certain families won't be in church when they're harvesting or planting.
No, it's really a dilemma now.
If you have a dairy farm, you have no choice. You milk those cows morning and afternoon, morning and evening, so it depends upon what kind of farm.
Yeah, absolutely. The cows aren't going to... No, and that's really important because sometimes the Sabbath is described with many different rationales in the Old Testament, and one of them is to give rest to your animals and give rest to your land, but obviously the cows don't need that kind of rest of not being milked. So it's out of kindness to the animals you would continue to milk. And Israel does not know about dairy farms. They do have sheep and goats, but it wasn't the same kind of intensive agriculture. So that's, of dairy farming. So they don't talk about that. But, yeah, obviously we've had to modify there. Anybody else on this one? Well, keep bringing in insights from farming, because you all know a lot more than I do about this. But anyway, what I wanted to start with is sort of this kind of all-encompassing understanding, at least in one strand of the Old Testament, the Yahwist, and I think we see it also in the prophets, that the sort of basic life of a typical Israelite was to be a small farmer, a subsistence farmer. They grew mixed crops of wheat and barley, chickpeas. We can see this all archaeologically. When they dig at various tells or various sites, they see what people have been eating. Chickpeas, where we get hummus from, that was a principal crop. Barley, olives. They had some vineyards and orchards. They had olives for oil, but it was all sort of local and small. A lot of the farmers in the hill country did also have sheep and goats as a kind of an insurance policy on the hoof, as it were. In good years, they just milked the sheep and the goats for milk and for yogurt. In bad years, if they have to sell some, then that's a kind of a policy there. You've got some wealth accumulated in the sheep and goats, and you would sell one when you needed to. So it was a subsistence kind of traditional family farm that was this normative view. At least for the hill country. Now, down on the plains, near the ocean, there was probably from the outset more centralized agriculture with elites more in control. But in the hill countries, it was supposed to be each one on their own farm, at least initially. And that seems to be the vision of this Yahwist writer. At least one strand is this farming life. But all was not well, or didn't continue well for very long. And I guess I want to just sort of talk about a shift that seems to have taken place in the agricultural economy of Israel and Judah, the two kingdoms there in the Old Testament prophets that we can see, and then talk about how that also might relate to our farm economy and our situation today. And again, we all have to share wisdom and insights here, because I'm not a particular expert on the farm situation. In the Roman Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter on the Columbia River watershed, obviously farming is a major component of this. I mean, this watershed has a lot of farmers. I'll just read this section here. This is in the first part. Remember, I talked about it was divided into four, all kind of around the theme of the river of life. The analysis of the current situation is called the rivers of our moment, and then they do the history under the rivers of our memory. The rivers of our vision is sort of what are we going to do about this problem, and the rivers as our responsibility lays out some specifics. But anyway, as part of the analysis, agriculture is a valuable contributor to community life and economic well-being in our region, in the Columbia River watershed. The watershed contains some of the richest soil in the United States. Maybe those of you from the Midwest would want to dispute that, but I know from when I was pastor up here, there is a section of eastern Washington, Idaho called the Palouse, where most of the lentil production in our country is from, and some potatoes. I mean, it is very wonderful agricultural land. In eastern Washington, there's a lot of farm and other places too. Some of the richest soil in the U.S. and a lengthy growing season. Some operations are dependent on the energy supplied by dams. These same dams, however, have taken agricultural productive land out of agricultural use. Yet, owner-operated family farms are on the decline, with consequent impacts on rural businesses, rural schools, and rural communities. The same issues that are hitting farms in the Midwest are hitting out here, of course, that family farming is really declining. And what do we say about that as people of God? Do we say anything? Does it have anything to do? When I was back in Minnesota in the 1980s, the Roman Catholic bishops in southern Minnesota wrote a pastoral letter called Community in the Heartland, where they talked about sort of the deteriorating of community as farm population is forced to move into the cities, and what do we say or do about it? I mean, it's a dilemma, and it's been going on now for several generations, but it's a huge sort of shift in the structure of American political economy in our life as a country. So keep that in mind as we take a look at some texts here and look at what was happening in Israel in the 8th century BC, so a long time ago, basically. And I'm going to, as I said, I probably shouldn't even be doing this Old Testament stuff with you, because I am not principally an Old Testament scholar. My expertise is the New Testament, and so I have to rely on other scholars for some of this stuff, but I'm so intrigued by it, and I guess I'm so convinced that we really need to think about the Bible and ecology issues that I wanted to work through some of this with you, but I apologize in advance that I have to look at some articles here to walk through this material. But there, and I'll be principally using an article by this guy named Marvin Chaney called Bitter Bounty. And I think those two words there are really intriguing. And that's the, in the, some ways the dilemma we face right now, the bounty of agricultural production when you get a centralized kind of agricultural system is in some ways a bitter bounty and in some ways not. I mean, it's a bounty. The question is it a bitter bounty? His argument is going to be basically that in Israel, due to both internal and external forces in the 8th century, internally it was the people clamoring for a king. And we're going to look at a text in 1 Samuel in a minute that shows that. That then started stratifying Israelite society. So it was no more sort of everybody as a subsistence peasant farmer, but rather there were distinct classes of people. There were the peasant farmers who were getting squeezed. Then there were the merchants and the elites, and finally the rulers. And that it became a more stratified, hierarchical, social class system in Israel, and that that had consequences for the farmers at the bottom of the heap. So that's the internal one. Once you get a king, you've got royalty and you've got elites, you've got your whole retinue of other elites part of this. And then external pressures as well, that foreign powers were always threatening Israel. That's part of why they wanted a king, was to defend against that. But in the end, his thesis is that what happened is there was a shift from this local subsistence kind of farming to a more export-import dominated kind of farming, and that that was destructive for the peasants because they ended up being squeezed off their land or having to become debt farmers on their land. So let's look at some of the texts and that he sort of makes his case on and then talk about that issue. All right, if you'll jump ahead a few books, out of the Pentateuch, I should have written these passages on the board. Let's look at 1 Samuel 8. After the period of the judges, then Israel started getting kings. And this chapter, 1 Samuel 8, can everybody find, I know it's hard to find these Old Testament books, there's so many of them, but it's right after the judges. If somebody would be willing to read verse 10 to the end of the chapter. This talks about we're picking it up in the middle of this chapter, which is the question of, does Israel need a king or not? Should they get a king? And Samuel warns, well, if you get a king, there's going to be consequences as far as what it does. Namely, the king is going to take the best of your lands and your produce, and you're going to see developing this class system with a more stratified society. It's a trade-off because they need a king in some ways to defend against military incursions from other nations, but there's going to be a downside to the king. And as we read this passage, take a look about what it's saying about how there are going to be changes in agriculture, namely. Somebody willing to read here?
So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking a king from him. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen."
So that's military. They're going to get drafted.
"And to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariot. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles." And when Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, hearken to their voice and make them a king. Samuel then said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city.
Okay. So then they do get a king. The question is, you know, it's this. There's this tension in 1 Samuel, the anguish of, you know, you could say they do get a king and everything goes downhill from there. On the other hand, you could say they do get a king and everything goes uphill from there. You know, that's sort of the dilemma here. But Samuel is warning them what it's going to look like as far as changes in their political and economic structure when you start to have tiers of rulers. And what is it? What's going to happen? What are some of the things he notes? The draft, right, for military purposes. The reason you'd have a king is so you can go to war more and it's going to take the best of your sons. What else?
Taxes.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's going to be significant. I mean, he's going to take from your produce. What else?
Take the workers.
Yeah. Take the workers. And even take some of the fields, right? The king now became an owner, and you see this in other areas, like in, you know, look at the Middle Ages, how the rulers owned some of the best of the land and then rented it out to the sharecroppers. The king, in verse 14, is actually going to own now some of the fields and vineyards and olive orchards. And there's going to be plots that the rulers own now, and it's going to be a different kind of economy. And people are going to end up having to rent their own land. Even that's what ends up happening. And the question is it inevitable or not? Is it good or is it bad or is it both or what? Cheney talks about in this article what happened in the 8th century and then continuing through about the 6th century until the Babylonians destroyed everything and took the elites into exile, when then those who stayed on the land were the poorest of the poor and they lived somewhat like they had originally, is that there was a shift in agricultural production. With the rise of the elites, there was a shift to more pressure to intensify agriculture and to go less diversified and more into monocultural production, raising crops for export. And this would be principally plant more vineyards and more olive trees, because it was the oil, the olive oil, that was most efficiently exported, and also the wine. And where it's exported to is this maritime empire here called Tyre, a great Phoenician city up the coast. I'll try to draw a map, but I'm not very good at maps, so those of you who are, who've been there, you know. If this is Turkey here, like this, and this is Palestine, and Israel and Judah are kind of here, and Lebanon is here, Phoenicia is basically here. It's a city on the Mediterranean, not too far away, that apparently had a fabulous harbor, an incredible harbor, and became this enormous sort of trading empire. They themselves did not grow a lot of their own food, nor did they have much land of their own, but what they were was the shipping hub for the whole Mediterranean world. And elites from all the countries around there would trade their goods through Tyre. Tyre got its food that way, and in return would trade these luxury things that elites in every country wanted, namely purple dyed fabric, scarlet fabric, ivory, silks, and luxury goods, gold and silver and that kind of thing that Israel did not have. Remember, purple was the most expensive kind of fabric there was, because purple dye came from these shelled creatures, some kind of crustacean that lived,
snails
that lived under the water. People had to dive very deep to get the snails that would make the purple dye. So this was the most elite of the elite. Whenever you see purple in the Bible, you know this is really expensive. This is something only rich people and royalty can afford, is purple. And that's what you see starting to be traded. Everybody wanted this then. I mean, it's like the designer clothes. You know, you're trading away the crops of your subsistence farmers in order to get these luxury goods. Cheney argues that you can see this both in texts in the Bible and also that it's corroborated by archaeological evidence from the digs that are taking place in Israel now, where you find at this time an increase in evidence that that wine and oil were being traded. You find these, the jars that they were traded in. I mean, obviously they didn't have the same kind of cargo storage that we do now, but these big, huge jars were called amphora, and you see more evidence of those. And but let's take a look at a couple texts where you read about Tyre, which is where everybody basically traded their stuff. First, Isaiah 23. We're going to go into the prophets now, so you have to skip ahead. If somebody finds the page number in a Bible that you think a lot of other people have, then you can tell us what it is. I know we're all looking at different versions here. 643, okay, and in mine it's 664, Isaiah 23. Anyway, Isaiah's a little further after Psalms here. Yeah, let's take a look at Isaiah 23, 1 through 3, and then 8 to 10, if somebody would be willing to read that. And this is about Tyre. This is an indictment of Tyre, because Isaiah sees the injustices of this kind of economy. Tyre is not yet fallen. It hasn't been destroyed, even though it later got destroyed, but he's already sort of pronouncing its destruction upon it. And notice how much of it is in terms of its trade with the nations around it. So would somebody be willing to read 1 through 3 and 8 to 10 here?
The oracle concerning Tyre. Well, O ships of Tarshish, for your fortress is destroyed. When they came in from Cyprus, they learned of it. Be still, O inhabitants of the coast, O merchants of Sidon. Your messengers crossed over the sea and were on the mighty waters. Who has planned this against Tyre?
Oh, a little more. Can you just finish three a little more there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, oops. And we're on the mighty waters. Your revenue was the grain of Shihor, the harvest of the Nile. You were the merchant of the nations. Now eight. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honor of the earth. Oh, the Lord of hosts has planned it, to defile the pride of all glory, to shame all the honored of the earth. Cross over to your own land, O ships of Tarshish. This is a harbor no more.
Thanks. Okay, so notice the indictment is this merchants of the sea. You're the great sort of global grain trader, the Cargill or whatever of the ancient world. Don't quote me on that. you know, it's at least this prophet, at least Isaiah sees it as problematic that Tyre has managed to become the merchant of grains and is trading everything. And the projection of the downfall is this will be a harbor no more. I mean, no longer. When things get good again and are according to God's will, Tyre will not be able to be this kind of shipping magnet and this kind of globalized empire here that trades everybody's stuff. One where you see even more specifically, and notice it was the grain there of Shihor that's being traded in verse 3. Israel and Judah are part of this. If you take a look two prophets later at Ezekiel, after Isaiah you've got Jeremiah, but the next one after that is Ezekiel, and take a look at Ezekiel 26 and 27. Ezekiel has a whole set of oracles against foreign nations here, and this is one of the longest. It's actually a 3-chapter long oracle. It's 26 through 28. He is really upset with Tyre. And it's very interesting. In chapter 26, he's using different metaphors to talk about the destruction of Tyre. In chapter 26, the metaphor is a kind of Rock of Gibraltar image of Tyre. Obviously, this... I haven't been to Tyre, but it must have been this incredible rocky fortress that really had a fabulous harbor. And so what he does in chapter 26 is say the Lord God is going to destroy Tyre by scraping it down to the rock. It's going to be the sea waves that are going to come up and destroy it. Look in verse 4, they shall destroy the walls of Tyre, break down its tires. I will scrape its soil from it and make it a bare rock. It shall become in the midst of a sea a place for the spreading of nets. So that's like the destruction from the sea that's described in 26. Then in chapter 27, that's one I want to look at. Chapter 27 is a masterful metaphor here, which is personifying the empire of Tyre as itself a merchant ship. that is constructed out of all the woods that have been traded from Lebanon, you know, the huge timbers that were cut down from the beautiful cedars of Lebanon. Its sails, you can see in verse 5 there, this is talking about the ship of Tyre. O Tyre, you have said, I am perfect in beauty. Verse 5, they made all your planks of fir trees from Seir. They took cedar from Lebanon to make a mast for you. From the oaks of Bashan they made your oars. They made your deck of pines from the coast of Cyprus, inlaid with ivory. This is a critique, I think, of the deforestation that was happening as people cut down their forests and traded the logs for stuff. So this ship is being constructed out of all the stuff that Tyre traded. Fine embroidered linen from Egypt was your sail. Blue and purple, your awning. So what he does in this chapter is say this ship goes out onto the high seas, and there's cargoes on it. It's full of wares from all the different lands, and then it sinks at the end of this chapter. But look at some of the cargoes that are listed in the cargo list beginning in verse 12. Because I think he's an astute observer of this global trade that was happening through Tyre. So he tells you what every country traded for what. Tarshish did business with you out of the abundance of your great wealth. And then it's metals there, other nations. Look down at verse 17, because here's where you see Judah and Israel and what's happening with their agricultural economy. Judah and the land of Israel traded with you. They exchanged for your merchandise wheat, millet, honey, oil, and balm. And then it goes on to tell what the other countries trade. But here's Israel and Judah selling and trading their agricultural stuff through Tyre in order to get some of these luxury goods for the elites. And so the reason Cheney calls his article Bitter Bounty is the idea that the elites of Israel were able to get to force a sort of intensification of agricultural production, more wine, more oil, but the benefits of it in terms of trade weren't benefiting the small farmers. In fact, and I'll just quote here, he writes, as part of the 8th century intensification of agricultural in the hill country of Israel and Judah, multi-purpose land, which had helped to spread risk, that is by having all these different crops and the animals, you know, you sort of had contingency plans. If one failed, you had the others. This was gradually converted into terraces growing vineyards and olive trees. While elite demands on their production tended to be steady or to increase, that production itself was subject to the vicissitudes of the environment and in the case of the olive to a pattern of alternating yields. Gone was the, quote, inefficient diversification which had spread the risk around. This more intensive cultivation was considered more efficient, but it also meant for individual peasants more risk, and in fact led to what he calls a kind of rent capitalism economy or a command economy where the elites were more in control. Such a system pressed the typical peasant cultivator hard, even in good years, because there was an incentive for the elite to extract every possible surplus for trade, leaving only the barest subsistence necessary to continue production. In less than optimal years, cultivators were stripped of the insurance of diversification and were now forced to take out survival loans. And in fact, this is a pattern that you see continuing even into the New Testament. Have you ever wondered why in the Gospels there's so much talk about debtors and loans and stuff? The system of farming by that time seems to have really broken down. Under Roman control, by the time of the New Testament, Rome occupied Israel and Judah. It wasn't just their own elites that were extracting from them. It was a foreign occupier. And all these layers are being taken off for taxes and tributes to Rome. And the peasants are basically debt farmers by that point. They don't own their own land anymore. They're living on having to mortgage themselves and constantly in debt, can't get out of it. And that's the agricultural shift that started already in the 8th century BC, Cheney argues, and that was part of this system of people wanting to trade more for export and grow less for their own peasants. And it was driven by the elites and their desire for luxury goods to be exchanged. What do you think about that?
Sounds familiar.
Does it sound familiar? Okay, how does it sound familiar? Those of you who are from farms, yeah, what sounds familiar?
Well, of the organization, the farms going into huge operations instead of the small diversified family farms. It was, when I was growing up, it was a diversified. We grew corn and oats and beans, and we had cattle.
How many cattle did you have?
Oh, we just had about 8 milk cows and then had the calves that we would grow for and sell for beef, and we butcher our own. We had pigs, just 8 or 10 sows maybe with the little ones, and sell those, butcher what we needed, and had chickens.
How many chickens did you have?
Oh, maybe a couple hundred. I mean, just...
But it was so diversified. Every farm was diversified.
And the children helped with all of the chores, and milk cows morning and night for all through school.
And where was this?
In Central Iowa.
Central Iowa. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now what's happening? Do you see?
Now my two nephews are farming the home farm, but they have just had to give up their hog operation because the huge hog factories that have taken over so much, and the prices are down so that they just couldn't make any money on it. They have a few sheep just to kind of keep the yards and farm that cleared, but then they've had to take jobs outside the farming jobs in well, one's in a grain elevator, the other's in a seed company, so it's farm-related, but it's...
Yeah, that's the story right there. Did any of you see, it was on public television, I think this video called Farm Wife, wasn't it? Was that the name of it?
Farmer's Wife.
The anguish of farmers today, of the economics just being squeezed from every side. Yeah, and some turn to these hog containment facilities. You see that in Iowa, Indiana, other places to try to make ends meet. But then that has huge environmental consequences as far as the spreading of the manure. I mean, the smell. This has been an issue in North Carolina, for example, some of these hog farms. And then the neighbors saying, you know, this is no way to use land, and the sort of dilemma of how to continue to farm and yet make it this economy.
Well, I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, but now live in a small town in Western Illinois that is very rural, a lot of farm economy, and I don't think people in the city have any clue how severe this problem is, and that it really is something that's going to affect them down the road. Because it seems so isolated. You buy your food in the grocery store, you have no clue all the process that gets there. And since I've lived out in a rural area, I'm much more in tune with how serious this is, and members of our congregation that are in severe financial trouble and that sort of thing. And it's something that the whole country has to address, or we're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, and the role of the global economy, and we have thought, or farmers thought, oh, this was good, you know, to really do a lot of export and stuff, but then the downside is when there's collapse in Asia or whatever, I mean, then the price is really dropping. It doesn't
have
to be.
If you have a good crop, the price goes so low that you still lose money.
Yeah.
That's what's happening this year where we live.
In southern Minnesota, too, when you drive through, you think there are little farms, but really those people are just employed, and the corporation is owned. They can't even trace it. They'll trace it to banks, and the corporation keeps changing, and it's usually foreign investors that own this and run it eventually, because their checks come from a series, because some of the higher people have tried to find out who it is that's employing them, who's buying up all this land. And so it's kind of a mystery.
I thought there were laws against foreign companies owning
for a while. Well, because of their hiding it, because they change names so much, so it's a whole... It becomes very complicated.
Ron, you hit it.
My brother farms in South Dakota. I was home right after the 4th of July. We counted up the number of farms that he is now farming when we were kids. The number of farms when we were kids that he's now farming, it's 12. So 12 families no longer farm those farms. And before that, as a kid, we watched a whole group of farms be brought together. Now, the land isn't as good as Iowa or other places, but I would guess he's farming, what was at one time, something like 50 farms.
Huh.
The difficulty about this is that as he sees it, he's not a large operator. Ultimately, he will have to sell to someone else. And what's going to happen, I think, is that in a very short time, a lot of land and a lot of the property and all of the operations are going to end up in the hands of a very, very few people, which will then cause all of us to pay more for our food.
And the communities will no longer be there. I mean, the church is really facing it now as more and more little towns are losing their congregations. You know, they're just the people. Well, North Dakota is losing population. I don't know if South Dakota is. They are losing, okay, even though Sioux Falls is growing and stuff. Uh-huh. Couple.
Yeah, I don't know that this is just an issue facing farmers. I grew up on a farm and I see the same thing.
Can you speak a little louder?
Sorry. Grew up on a farm and you know, see the same thing happening there, but I now live in Port Angeles where the loggers who for years worked, you know, small logging operations, and then, you know, the more mechanized and the more sophisticated the operations became, the more that it's changed. They're on the jobs there now for people, and I don't know. I don't know that I'm explaining this very well, but I think that when I see subsidizing of logging, road building, or subsidizing of butter, you know, how long can we carry on subsidizing things that are just, they're not working economically anymore?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a dilemma. And then the size issue is a real one, too. I mean, the fact that, in a sense, the bigger you get, the more, quote, efficient it is. And yet the downside is, who benefits? It's only a very few, you know, so that as small loggers lose their job and things consolidate. I know, it's the dilemma right now. I mean, I don't have any answers.
You. I'm not sure that I agree with that. You know, when you say who benefits, there's certainly people who are affected. But, you know, like the person over here said, you know, the people that live in a city are clueless as to what's involved with the dilemma and the challenges of the farmers. But who is benefiting there? Well, it's all the people that live in the city that pay, you know, 39 cents a pound for bananas or whatever it is that they pay for things. But certainly there are a group of people that are affected, just like with the loggers. Just like with any industry that is going on with this globalization and consolidation of any industry, no matter which one you want to pick. And I certainly there is a lot of consolidation of that wealth going to industries or, I don't know if it's a few people, but that's just part of, I guess, part of the dynamic that is going on, and what I see in addition to that is that all of the different issues that people have mentioned just in here today, everyone has an agenda, and everyone has, and all of these things are interrelated with each other. You can't come to a solution if you can't accurately define really what the problem is.
And we won't agree even then, probably.
And we can't agree on anything.
You had a comment there?
I'm in the very late 50s, I met a man who was growing a cantaloupe in California, and the price fell so low for cantaloupe that he had to plow his entire crop under. And I asked him why he couldn't allow people from large institutions like hospitals or whatever to come and pick some of the melons, and he said, no, they want us to pick them and deliver them. And he had a nervous breakdown that year. Mm-hmm. His whole work for the year he had plowed.
Well, and we see that now today on farms, the high rate of suicide. I mean, that came out in that video too. The anguish that farm families are feeling is very great. in this course that I taught last semester with Ted Hebert on the Bible and ecology, one of the last days we went to visit a farm in northern Indiana that one of our students lives on. Her father-in-law farms it. And we spent the day visiting other farmers too there. He talked about much what you're talking about, Ron, that he now has 1,000 acres. There was a novel by Jane Smiley of that, oh, and a movie too, about the sort of the 70s farm crisis, or 80s, I guess that was. But anyway, he made it through that, and he has 1,000 acres, and seems very prosperous. But he sort of talked about these dilemmas, and in the end said, and we heard this from several of the farmers in that community, this idyllic little town in northern Indiana called Union Mills. He said, I have to quite honestly say I would not encourage my children to go into farming. And I was just with a bunch of rural pastors in Colorado at a conference too, and it was very interesting. Many of them are pastors from Nebraska, Iowa, rural Minnesota, Kansas. They said the same thing. I would not encourage my children to become pastors. I think there's a whole shift that's taking place. No, pastors, because of the dilemma that rural congregations are facing. I mean, this is a crisis for our rural communities, and it's a real anguishing thing. The degree to which the globalization of our whole economy is good, and yet the cost, I mean, that's sort of the dilemma, and that's not an easy answer. You have a hand?
Well, I think, too, if we look at, I was talking to my friend back in Minnesota who's a dairy farmer. He said, if you look at back in the 70s to the 90s, the price of a gallon of milk for the farmers get is not much higher. You know, their profit has just been so limited compared to the middleman getting most of it. And, you know, they have to farm more to make more money, because their prices haven't.
Yeah, and it's interesting ecologically. I mean, why I want to look at this issue of the Bible and ecology is the dilemma. We heard this from some of the dairy farmers. We did it. The whole question of this bovine growth hormone, for example, do you use it or not? And what's sustainable? And how do we, I mean, I think all of us would agree, at least the Lutheran Church this summer is going to have a statement at the National Assembly in Denver about, it's called A Just and Sustainable Livelihood for All. I mean, I think fundamentally we all would like to be doing something that's sustainable, that's not going to be destructive overall. And how do you have a way that of doing agriculture or logging or whatever that's sustainable and that can benefit everyone? That's part of the dilemma. It's not sustainable to continue to do more and more artificial.
My brother's a dairy farmer in northern Wisconsin. He's been for 20 years. He's going to turn 50 in about 10 days. And when I visited him in May, he told me that when he bought his farm in 1979, I don't remember the numbers, but the price he had was for grade B milk, which he said that whenever you buy a farm and you're the first time farming on it, you have to start at grade B. He makes less money per pound, per hundredweight of milk in 1999 for his grade A milk than he made for grade B 20 years ago. He's now 20 years older. He's had to double the amount of cows that he himself can take care of in order to sustain the bills and everything that to keep the farm going, because he's just himself. He doesn't have anybody working for him. So I could see the real wear and tear on his body, because he has to double the amount of work just to keep up with all of this.
Okay, well, we've obviously got some real stories of anguish here, and I don't want to cut off discussion. I mean, I hope we'll continue. I just want to get back to the biblical question a little bit, which is, what do we do? Most of us don't live on the farm right now. In fact, zero of us in this room, right? But, you know, what does it mean if you agree with the thesis that at least one important strand of the Bible, perhaps the earliest, the Yahwist, has the image of humans fundamentally as in touch with the land, that we're made from humus and we are tilling the humus, that we're made from farmland and we're to till it. If we have sort of a fundamental kind of biological, God-given connection to the land, you know, what does that mean for our farm situation today? And what is the critique of sort of what developed in Israel mean for us today? I mean, I don't have any easy answers. In some ways, all of these prophets are kind of reactionaries. You know, they're crying out against the system that they see happening, Isaiah and Ezekiel. Amos is another one. We could look at him. You know, he says, hear this, O you who trample the poor, who, you know, are trying to squeeze more, who are taking securities for loans. You know, in the Old Testament, it's very clear, you do not get interest on loans. So you had to start disobeying that early on in order to get capitalism even. But, you know, forcing people into debt was a very bad thing. But maybe this is just, you know, a sort of romantic kind of reactionary voice. I mean, that's what I think. It's spooky, as Vi pointed out. Wow, sounds familiar. You read through this stuff, and how I first got involved with it is working on the book of Revelation, because what we're going to see tomorrow is that this critique of Tyre and these cargo lists in Ezekiel 27, long after Tyre fell and that empire was no more, in New Testament times, in the first century, the author of Revelation picks up on this very critique and uses it now against Rome, says, hey, just like what was happening with Tyre 5 or 6 centuries ago is now happening with the Roman Empire. It's a big maritime power. It's trading cargoes all over the Mediterranean world. Who benefits from this? Only the elites. And these luxury goods are traded. Little local farmers, peasant farmers in Asia Minor or in Galilee or throughout all the rural lands, the rich agricultural lands, are being squeezed by these same sort of forces as they're being forced to trade away their stuff on these cargo ships. And it's very kind of interesting to me how the pointed nature of this critique is one that continues even when it's a different empire that rules the world, namely Rome. And I think the whole dilemma of globalization that was obviously faced very differently back then might still have something to say to us today. And there's certainly, I guess the other important thing I want to say is there's not just one voice in the Bible. There are voices even in 1 Samuel that think having a king is a good thing. Just as we saw that in the book of Genesis, you can have two side-by-side, very different accounts of creation, the one by the priestly author, the one by the Yahwist, and they're both true. So too, you've got different perspectives on globalization also in the Bible. The question would be, though, are there times in our life as God's people that we need to hear the critique of the one? And is there a time to start, you know, rethinking NAFTA or all these things? You know, I mean, I think that's the question some are posing today. And certainly, what is sustainable? How long can we keep up this kind of agricultural economy with intensification of production based on fertilizers and everything? You know, is there a relationship between the biblical critique? I don't know. But the project that I want to work on next is the whole critique of deforestation, because I think, actually, we didn't look at this one passage on Monday. Why don't you just take a look at, this is a whole separate thing, but talking about the forest, Isaiah 14. What's happened to me, and you're going to see, those of you who stay next week, I argue that most of what the fundamentalists read literally in the book of Revelation, we shouldn't read literally, we should read metaphorically. Namely, it's not a script for the end times. But some of the economic critique that's in the Bible that we've sort of saying, oh, you know, it's metaphor or whatever, I think some of this stuff is much more literally hard-hitting than we've ever seen. In Isaiah 14... I don't think we looked at this passage on Monday. This is one I had never seen, but Ted pointed it out to me in this course we're teaching. That part of what, and then, so empires rise and fall in the ancient world. Another really evil empire in Israel's view was Babylon, because it crushed them. It ultimately destroyed Jerusalem. But so this is the oracle that says, oh, if only Babylon would get destroyed. This is the taunt you're going to take up against the king of Babylon. Starting in verse 4. When Babylon falls, and it hasn't yet, how the oppressor has ceased, how his insolence has ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers that struck down peoples in wrath with unceasing blows, that ruled the nations in anger with unrelenting persecution. And the idea is when Babylon falls now, the whole earth is at rest and quiet, and they break forth into singing. And listen to this one now. The cypress trees exult over you, the cedars of Lebanon saying, since you were laid low, no one comes to cut us down anymore. You know, that's a really interesting one. I had never noticed that, but the idea that even the biblical writers see the deforestation that's happening, the immense logging that's going on, that's not to build local houses and stuff, but the logs are being shipped off to Babylon and other places. And the critique is, you know, when Babylon and these other global empires end, then even the trees will have a rest from that. It's a very pointed sort of critique that's that runs as a kind of a thread through the prophets, at least, who are these, you know, they speak out when they see things that they don't like. And maybe it's hopeless, their critique, you know, maybe they're just trying to call for an age that no longer can meet. But it's interesting to see these kind of globalization dilemmas in the Old Testament.
Another part of the deforestation that happened over there was later on when Turkey was in charge. Turkey taxed you on the number of trees in your land.
Huh.
So in order to get rid of that tax, you cut your trees down.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm.
And this was when they were ruined and so forth. And so now they're going back in and so forth and replanting that, but that was a big thing for it. That's why there's very few trees now.
Huh, that's really interesting, because a lot of, certainly in Asia Minor, which is now Turkey, a lot of what were ancient harbors, for example, Ephesus, are now silted in, and it's clear that this siltation has happened as a result of deforestation. So I think, I just want to pose this question to you, sort of, what is a sustainable vision of how we live as God's people on the land, you know, and how can we use the biblical critique as a resource for us?
Uh-huh. I think that right here in Holden Village is an example of that, because if you walk down to Ten Mile Falls, some of those Douglas firs are 200 or 300 years old, and yet they were slated to be cut down, as I understand it, and it was Holden Village that prevailed against the Department of Agriculture and the Forest Service.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the big blue ones with the crosses on them, the giant old growth. Yeah, there's not much old growth left. The whole question of, you know, is there a benefit to old growth or not? I think it sounds like you would say there is, to seeing those big trees. And then, of course, that has consequences for other people's livelihood and stuff. But
there's a little bit of what goes around comes around. On the eastern part of the United States, in the Northeast particularly, with sheep farming, I guess it was sheep farming, basically, deforested a large part of the Northeast, and now I don't know why or how, but it's being reforested, and a lot of the forest in the East is there because the old farms that made money by sheep farming, you know, 100, 200 years ago, no longer do that. It just didn't pay anymore. So the forest has come back. So what goes around comes back.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's actually more forests in portions of the Northeast now than there were 200 years ago.
Yeah, whereas out here, of course, there aren't. And it's a, you know, so the question is, how much can the earth recover from of our intensification? Yeah, and is it going to continue like that? In which case, we don't have to worry too much. But I guess I'm more worried about the overall issues of ecological devastation, global warming, certainly.
Pay a little bit more attention, perhaps. to the Amazon forest and deal with it and use it a little bit more intelligently.
In some of those areas, the consequences are, you know, may not be reversible in the short term because there's changes in the soils and you know, you...
Or even in the long
term. Tropics, you know, you cut the forest down all at once, the soil changes, the nutrients get leached out, and it won't regrow the forest like it might here, for instance.
Well, okay, it's time for coffee break. We don't want to miss our snack here. So let the conversation continue at coffee break.